Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
It's my absolute delight to be able to welcome to the festival Yuval Noah Harari, who is the author of the awesome book Sapiens. I don't want to make too many puns about the fact that it's a brief history of humankind, but it is a most extraordinary book, full of gems of information about everything. We obviously can't cover the whole thing tonight, so we're going to try and talk about some specific parts and then allow some time for you all to come in and ask him questions. As I said, it's fantastic that you're here. We're so pleased to have you. So can we start right at the beginning? A long time ago, you know, animals like humans first appeared, as you say, about 2.5 million years ago. There were several people, if we want to call them that, like us. What was it like then?
Well, we are used to being the only humans around, and we think it's natural that wherever you go in the world, in Israel, in Britain, in Colombia, you find the same kind of humans. But actually, it's quite extraordinary, because with other animals, wherever you go in the world, you have different species. Like if you think about dolphins or bats or bears or vipers, you don't have the same vipers all over the world. And indeed, if you go back 50,000 years ago to visit planet Earth, you would find that you have at least 6 different human species populating different parts of the planet. We know for sure about 6 as of January 2016, but almost every year now they discover a new human species. And what should be emphasized is that all these different human species, not all of them are our ancestors. It's not that they are leading in a straight line towards us. At any particular moment, you had different human species living side by side on the planet. And eventually, as our ancestors, Homo sapiens, spread out of East Africa, they drove all the other human species to extinction, and we are the only ones left standing.
So how different were all the other species that were like us?
They could be quite different. I mean, maybe the most different is the dwarf species Homo floresiensis that the press likes to call the hobbits. Yeah. They lived on a small island in what is today Indonesia, the island of Flores. They got there about 800,000 years ago from the Asian mainland. Back then, they were probably about 100, a meter and a half high, or 1.67 meters high. But when they got to the island back then was connected to the mainland, and then the sea rose as a result of climate change, and a few humans got stuck on the island, and they underwent a process of becoming dwarfs because of a few resources on the island. So the big people die first, and the small people have an advantage, and generation after generation, they became smaller and smaller until eventually their height was about 1 meter. They weighed about 25 kilograms, like real dwarfs, but they were completely real. They knew how to use tools, how to use fire, how to hunt animals. So maybe this is the most extreme case of a different human species populating the planet back then. The last remnant of these dwarfs, of these Homo floresiensis, is dated to about 12,000 years ago. Just when Homo sapiens...
It's not that long ago.
No, it's yesterday morning in evolutionary terms.
Tell me a little bit about Neanderthals, because you say in the book that they had a... You say they had a bigger brain.
Yes, Neanderthals are the most famous other humans.
Yeah.
They lived in Europe and the Middle East. They were bigger, more muscular, and they had bigger brains than Homo sapiens. We don't really know what they did with all the extra neurons. It's a room for a lot of speculation. As Homo sapiens came out of East Africa, most Neanderthals were driven to extinction. But over the last 3 or 4 years, a new scientific project, the Neanderthal Genome Project, proved that there was also some intermarriages, or at least fertile sexual relations, between sapiens and Neanderthals, and up to 4% of the unique human genes of people from European and Middle Eastern origins, including you and me, I guess, have Neanderthal, are from Neanderthal ancestors. So it's quite amazing to realize that we Homo sapiens not only can have sex with an animal from a different species, we can actually have children together with an animal from a different species, which should cause us to rethink the way we view our place in the ecosystem. We are not inseparable. There is no like huge gap between us and the rest of the animals.
But how different were we from Neanderthals? I mean, you say that we could breed. So what would be, if you tried to make an example about, say, dogs or horses, or what would be similar today that we could understand?
Well, 100,000 years ago, it seems that there was no big difference between sapiens and Neanderthals. They lived similar lives, hunting and gathering, living in small bands, having stone tools, using fire and so forth. There was no clear advantage for sapiens over Neanderthals.
Although Neanderthals had the bigger brain.
Yes, but again, we don't really know what they did with them.
Okay.
Maybe they told funnier jokes or something. But again, when you look at the technology, at the stone tools, which is the best evidence we have, you don't see any advantage for Neanderthals over sapiens or vice versa. And then something about 70,000 years ago, everything changes.
Yes.
You see that sapiens is starting to do really extraordinary things in terms of technology, in terms of art. You see the beginning of art, beginning of commerce. Previously, humans did not trade with other bands. I mean, within the band, there were all kinds of exchanges, but one band of humans, whether sapiens or Neanderthal, did not trade with other bands. And then about 70, 60,000 years ago, you see the first evidence for trade among sapiens. And this is, again, from the archaeological evidence. You start finding, say, seashells very far from the sea. Or you start finding flint in places where there is no flint, and it must have been brought from other sapiens bands. So this was one big advantage of sapiens over Neanderthals. They could trade. And then you see the beginning of larger and larger networks of cooperation, not only in trade, also in hunting, also in politics. And this was the secret of success of our species, that whereas Neanderthals could cooperate, maybe 50 Neanderthals or 100 Neanderthals could cooperate, sapiens could cooperate in their hundreds and even in their thousands. So even if one versus one, Neanderthals were stronger and had these bigger brains, when it was 50 Neanderthals against 500 sapiens, the sapiens won.
So but very much of your book takes that idea of the human ability to control and work with huge numbers. And you say it's about because we can create an idea that is outside of ourselves. Can you explain how that works, that we have something to which we all aspire?
Yes, the basic idea is that, first, as I said, the sapiens secret of success is not individual intelligence, it's the ability to cooperate in large numbers.
But so do bees or termites.
The difference is that bees and termites and the other social insects, their cooperation is very rigid. There is basically one way in which a beehive functions. If there is a new danger, a new opportunity, the bees cannot change their social system overnight. They cannot, for example, execute the queen bee and establish a communist dictatorship of worker bees. It can't be done. Humans can do it. Humans change their social, their economic, their political system overnight, because our cooperation is not only in large numbers. The other key ingredient, it's very flexible. We can change it within our lifetime. And the reason is that whereas cooperation among bees is based on the genetic program, and cooperation among wolves or chimpanzees or elephants is based on intimate acquaintance, which is limited to a few dozen individuals, cooperation among Homo sapiens is based on fiction, on the imagination. We cooperate in hundreds and thousands and millions because we can invent fictional stories and convince everybody to believe in the same story, and as long as millions of people all believe in the same fiction, they all follow the same rules and they can cooperate, and all large-scale cooperation is based on that. It's clearest in the case of religion, where you have millions of people, they all believe some fiction about God and heaven, so they come together to wage war against the other human band, which again is something that no other animal can do. Chimpanzees have wars between neighboring bands, but it never happens that you come to the chimpanzee and say, look, if you die fighting against the other band, after you die, you'll go to chimpanzee heaven and receive lots of bananas and coconuts and so forth. So now risk your life in fighting against the other chimpanzee. But there are no suicide chimpanzee bombers.
Okay.
Never happens. But the crucial thing is that this is true not only of religion, it's true of all other networks of cooperation, it's true of the economy. Money and corporations are fictions, just like God and heaven. It's true of modern politics and the legal system. Nations and human rights are also examples of fiction.
Well, they
are
not a biological reality. So is the country of Colombia, isn't it, essentially?
Yep. The nations are not a physical reality, they are a story that people invent.
So, yeah, I really want to come on to money in a bit, but just going back all those years ago, what do you think were the first fictions that the early bands, the Sapiens, told each other?
That's a very good question. We don't really have a lot of evidence.
No, but I'm sure you have some ideas.
Yeah, the things for which we have evidence come either from art or from trade. And it leads me and other scholars to think that the first key fictions involved maybe ancestral spirits and other mythical beings, which were the basis for creating collaboration in large numbers, either in hunting and war or in trade. Even in order to trade with a stranger, you have to establish trust. And we know from anthropological evidence that even today, when hunter-gatherers or simple agricultural people, you meet somebody and he's a stranger, the first thing you do, unless you start killing each other, is to look for a common ancestor. If you somehow manage to find a common, even a mythical ancestor is good.
But a connection.
Then we are not strangers.
Yeah.
Then we are not strangers meeting in the jungle. We are both part of the same family. And it can be a complete fiction. It doesn't matter. And this is the basis for trade. Even today, you take a dollar bill or a Colombian peso, you will always find mythical ancestors on the piece of paper. They come in two shapes. Either they are God, like in the dollar, in God we trust, which means in the money we trust, but we need God to trust the money. And the alternative is the great mythical ancestors. In the case of the US, you have Franklin and Lincoln and all these dead presidents on the dollar. They are mythical, I mean, they are real people, they lived. And also many of the mythical ancestors of ancient people may have been real people at some time. They become mythical figures when the stories we tell about them become far more important than the actual events and actions of these people 100 or 200 years ago.
So just again, going back to the before the agricultural revolution, which I really want to get onto in a minute, but just one more question. All the way through the book, or certainly through the beginning, I kept thinking, my God, we were horrible. that we destroyed everybody in our path, and we got to this point of really of a domination, and actually everything. And you talk about previous extinctions of species. I mean, the fact that we are destroying the planet now is nothing new. So what was it about us that got rid of all, well, the six we know and all the others we may not know about? Was there a ruthlessness and ambition that is inherent in, say, in us that was not there in the Flores and in Neanderthal and in all the other creatures?
Homo sapiens is certainly very ruthless. It doesn't mean that Neanderthals weren't ruthless. It just means that they were less powerful than we. Maybe they're also less ruthless. I don't know. But certainly Homo sapiens was ruthless, and even before the agricultural revolution, Homo sapiens was responsible not only for the extinction of all other human species, but also for the extinction of about 50% of all the large mammals of the planet. In Australia, it was about 95% of the first humans reached Australia about 45,000 years ago, and within a few thousand years, 95% of the species of large animals in Australia became extinct. In America, the first Homo sapiens reached America about 15,000 years ago.
And they came down through Alaska.
They came from Siberia and the Bering Strait and Alaska and then down. And within 2,000 years, about 70% of the large mammals of America became extinct. As far as we know, there was no like master plan, let's exterminate all the mammoths and all the mastodons and all the big animals. It was more the result. I mean, humans, you can say about them not only that they are ruthless, even more importantly, they have a very hard time realizing the consequences of their actions. They usually think one, two, three steps ahead. They are unable, usually, to understand what it will mean 10 steps ahead or 20 steps ahead. So humans probably did not have any intention to exterminate the mammoth, but it was the result of their actions. In the case of the other humans, though, the Neanderthals and so forth, in this case, there is good reason to think that we really wanted to get rid of all the others. They were, in a way, too similar to us to ignore them and too different to tolerate them. And if you think about how today or during history, humans treat other groups which differ from them simply in skin color or language, then how would we treat a different species of humans? It's easy to imagine.
To understand why we did that. So that is one very big thing that makes us different from any other species, that we want to destroy our own.
Again, with regard to motivation, I'm not absolutely certain it's unique. We are unique in having the ability
to destroy.
As I said earlier, chimpanzees, for example, have territorial wars between neighboring chimpanzee bands, and there are even a few cases witnessed by scientists of a chimpanzee genocide, of one group of chimpanzees systematically killing, one after the other, most of the members of the neighboring chimpanzee band. And we have it with other mammals, we have it with insects, with ants, with termites, and so forth. The real difference is in the ability of humankind, that we are capable of destruction, also of creation, but of destruction on a completely different scale than any other animal. I mean, there have been previous cases of mass-scale extinctions in the history of planet Earth. All of them were caused by immense natural forces, like 65 million years ago, an asteroid from outer space, which hit the planet and caused the extinction of all the dinosaurs. But it never happened that a single species of, say, lizard or bear or whatever was responsible for such an extinction event. We now, and not only now, even thousands of years ago, have power of destruction on the same level as an asteroid from outer space.
Yeah, of course. When the agricultural revolution happened, what were we like at that point as a species?
In terms of individuals, we're similar to what we are today.
Yeah.
Perhaps more smart and more capable than we are today.
You sort of imply that we were happier. Is that right, reading of how you describe it? That we had more ability because we were non-specialists?
Yeah, I mean, let's get to the question of happiness in a minute. What we can be quite sure of is that people before the agricultural revolution, say 20,000 years ago, the average individual was smarter and more skillful than the average individual today, simply because you couldn't survive otherwise. In the modern society, you can survive by specializing in something very, very narrow, like writing history books. And you don't know much about anything else.
Yeah. But you don't have to get your own food.
Yeah, but you don't have to get, I mean, to get your food, to get your clothes, to get your shoes, your house, everything. I mean, you just write books or teach in university, you get money, and you buy all of that from other people. So you know a lot about a very narrow field. 20,000 years ago, you needed to know everything yourself. How to get your food, how to prepare your clothes, how to face all kinds of dangers and problems. So people probably were much more on the individual level. They knew much more, they're more skillful. There is also some reason to believe they are happier.
Yeah.
Mainly because our bodies and our minds evolved for millions of years in adaptation to living as hunter-gatherers. Going to the forest, climbing trees, picking apples, running after gazelles and things like that. After the agricultural revolution, most people, what they do is things that are not really, their bodies and minds are not really adapted for. Whether it's agriculture, or whether it's industry, or whether it's working as a cashier in a supermarket, this is not what this body and this mind evolved to do. And therefore, if you think about many of the jobs people perform today, they seem much less, much more boring.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, the person who made this shirt,
sure,
maybe in some sweatshop in Bangladesh or wherever, working 14 hours a day.
And only making shirts.
Only making shirts, the same, not even the shirt, just the button, this button, that's it. And in
that's
a
grim,
crowded, noisy, polluted factory, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. Compare that to going to the woods to look for mushrooms. Yeah. I think most people would think that going to the woods to look for mushrooms is more interesting.
So you take a very, well, most people look back on the agricultural revolution and say, wow, that was amazing. That was the time when, you know, people could start to be artists and teachers and politicians because someone else made their food. But in fact, you call it history's biggest fraud. Why?
Well, first of all, after the agricultural revolution, yes, a few people could be teachers or artists or politicians, but maybe 5% of the population. 95% were peasants. We normally think about the results of the agricultural revolution from the viewpoint of, I don't know, Greek philosophers walking around Athens and discussing the nature of the universe because they have slaves that keep them well fed. If you look at the agricultural revolution from the viewpoint, not of Socrates, but from the viewpoint of Socrates' slave, or the peasant in some village outside Athens, then suddenly the agricultural revolution looks far less appealing. And it's not only what I mentioned earlier, that our bodies and minds are not really adapted to bringing water from the river to the field and harvesting the corn and grinding the corn and so forth. In addition, nutrition for most people deteriorated as a result of agriculture. Prior to the agricultural revolution, humans, hunter-gatherers, ate dozens of different species of plants and animals and mushrooms and fish and whatever. So they got a very balanced nutrition, full of all the minerals and vitamins and so forth that they needed. After the agricultural revolution, until the 20th century, in most civilizations, the vast majority of the population, the peasants, subsisted by eating just a very limited number of staple crops, like potatoes in the Andes, like
rice
in East Asia, or maize in Central America. This was a much poorer diet than previously, and they suffered far more from infectious diseases, which came mostly from domesticated animals. Hunter-gatherers had very few infectious diseases. And on top of all that, you now had the social hierarchies and exploitation. Hunter-gatherers lived in relatively egalitarian society, small bands without property, whereas peasants lived in hierarchical societies in which a small elite dominated and exploited everybody else. So if you look at it from the viewpoint of the average individual, the agricultural revolution doesn't sound like a very good deal.
Yeah, and it is the deal with which we've lived in one way or another. So, and I want to take an enormous kind of jump here, because I know you've got so much more I want to ask you about. But so, in a way, we muddled along for a very long time, and in a way, a lot of things didn't change for many thousands of years until we get to what you describe as the cognitive revolution.
The scientific revolution.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also the revolution of language and the revolution of organization. And there were certain key moments in our progress.
Yes.
Which ones do you think are the most significant at that took us from, in a way, agricultural revolution to where James Lovelock would call it the Anthropocene, when we got into this moment of the Industrial Revolution, when everything starts to speed up, which we can talk about in a minute. But if you could take us through, gosh, just 10,000 years.
After the agricultural revolution, which is about 10,000 years ago, the next big landmark is really the scientific revolution, which starts around 500 years ago, and which is still ongoing, maybe just starting. We can't be sure about it. And the key insight of the scientific revolution, the key discovery of the scientific revolution, was a discovery of ignorance. We tend to think about the scientific revolution as a revolution of knowledge, but it's actually, in a fundamental way, a revolution of ignorance. Because prior to the rise of modern science, all human societies were based on the assumption that we already know the answers to all the important questions. All the answers are in the Bible, or in the Quran, or in the Vedas, or in the teaching of the old wise people of the past, or of this God or that God. And this was the basic assumption of most societies, which is why there was little incentive to look for new knowledge. Maybe we can find something new about some unimportant issue, but all the important things are already known. Then science came along, the modern scientific revolution, with this amazing insight that actually we are ignorant. There are many important questions whose answers are unknown to us. And this gave an immense impetus to start looking for new knowledge, because the assumption was, still is, that if we can gain important new knowledge, this will give us more power. We could do things that previously we couldn't.
But what made that happen? I mean, what stopped the kind of belief in religions, in ideas, and said, actually, we don't know things? What either gave us the confidence, or what is it? What was there, a spark, a person, a place?
We don't really know. I mean, it started in Europe in the late Middle Ages, early modern period. We don't know why there, why then.
Why not China?
Western Europe until that time was in the end of the world, a place where nothing interesting ever happened. No big religion came out of there, no big empire. Even the Roman Empire was really a Mediterranean empire, not a Western European empire. The really significant event, the one event you can point, which is the turning point, is the discovery of America. Because the discovery of America was a concrete example of the fact that Europeans didn't know very important things about the world. Usually when we talk about the scientific revolution, we tend to think about astronomy and Copernicus and Galileo and so forth, but nobody made any money from observing the stars. And nobody won any wars by understanding that the sun is in the center of the solar system and not the earth. But America was different. When Columbus set sail to America, Columbus is still a medieval person. He is still convinced that he knows everything about the world, and according to his prior knowledge and calculations, it should be easy to sail from Spain to East Asia, going westwards. And when he reaches America, until his last day, Columbus refuses to acknowledge that he discovered a new continent, because this was impossible. Why was it impossible? Because the Bible doesn't mention it, and the Greek philosophers and geographers don't mention it. For medieval people, the idea that an entire continent could be hiding somewhere, and God didn't know about it. Jesus didn't know about it. Moses didn't know about it. It's not possible. So they refuse to acknowledge that America is a new world, a new continent. And this is one of the reasons that America is called America and not Colombia. Yeah. Is that Columbus didn't take credit for his discovery. He said, no, it's some island off the coast of China. It's Japan. And then came along Amerigo Vespucci, who did nothing special except saying, look, this is a new continent. This is a new world. And in this sense, Amerigo Vespucci was the first modern person.
He was because he was prepared to accept that something he believed was not true.
Exactly. Amerigo Vespucci was the first modern person in the sense that he said, we are ignorant. The Bible doesn't have all the answers. Look, there is an entire new continent with gold and silver and slaves and empires and whatever that we can conquer if we only release ourselves from this idea that all the knowledge is already in the ancient traditions. And as the kind of irony of history, America was named after him. Mm-hmm. So a quarter of the world, basically, is named after a person whose great idea is to admit ignorance. And I think there is some historical justice in this situation.
Mm-hmm. So what happened after that put us into this speeding up life?
After that, what happens is that people, say, in Europe realize that by exploring, it starts with geography. The discipline that really launches the scientific revolution is not astronomy, it's not physics, it's geography. It's the basic idea that if you want to know the world better, just go out there and explore. Which, for medieval people, was really an extraordinary idea. I mean, why do we need to bother sailing ships to distant, unknown lands when we can just read the Bible? Everything is there.
But the Romans, I mean, they came to Britain, they went to Germany, I mean, they moved. I mean, Genghis Khan, I mean, all through history before that, people had traveled and found new places. Why was this so different?
It's the pace which is different. Most prior empires spread rather slowly, and they tended to spread into known territories. The Romans took about 400 years to get from Rome to London.
Okay, long time.
When the Spanish come to America, it takes them 10 years. After Cortes conquers Mexico, it takes them just 10 years to sail south and conquer the Inca Empire. They were so obsessed with discovering and conquering, it always goes together, discovering and conquering. You don't just discover for the sake of knowledge. You immediately want to take possession. It's a much, much faster process. It's the idea which is common both to modern conquerors and modern scientists that wherever you see a blank spot mm-hmm. on your map, you're drawn to it like butterflies to light. Because you say maybe there is something important there that I can discover and conquer. It starts with geography, but then it goes to all other disciplines, to physics, to chemistry, to biology, that you're drawn to the dark places. Because you tell yourself, maybe there is something important there, and if I discover it, I can have more power. So it starts with the power of imperialism in the 16th century, and today it's the power of biotechnology, of computer science, but the basic idea remains the same, that by gaining new knowledge, you can gain new power, mm-hmm. and that there is nothing that beyond the reach of human beings. The only thing that limits us is ignorance. For thousands of years, people lived with the impression that there are problems in the world that humans can never solve. Poverty, epidemics, hunger, famine, death, and old age. These are all part of God's plan.
But did people say that they couldn't help with those things? I mean, prior to...
You could help, but the idea that you could completely abolish famine from the world, this would have to wait until the second coming of Christ. Okay. Nothing that humans do can really abolish famine or war. But over the last two centuries, humankind has done the impossible. Today, thanks not to the second coming of Christ, thanks to the discoveries of scientists, for the first time in history, more people die today from eating too much than from eating too little.
Yeah.
And about 3 million people die each year from obesity.
Yeah.
1 million die from malnutrition.
From famine,
violence is also down. For thousands of people, for thousands of years, people thought the end of war will come only with the Messiah or when God intervenes. But over the last few decades, human beings by themselves reduced the incidence of violence to the lowest level ever. There are still some wars. I come from the Middle East, so I know. But much fewer than ever before. Again, many more people die from obesity than from war, terrorism, and crime combined. The average American is about 1,000 times more likely to be killed by McDonald's than by the Islamic State.
So, I'd like to find time to ask you about gender, just because I'm personally very interested. But I'd like to also ask you, you've got a very, very provocative line in the book where you say, does history have a direction? And you say, yes.
Yeah.
And you go, what do you mean? I mean, how can you say that? I mean, it gives history a sense that history's got its a personality and exists in some way outside of us. Is that the right way or the wrong way to look at it?
When I say that history has a direction, I mean that when you look at thousands of years of history, at first sight, it just seems chaos. One empire rises and then falls, and then another empire, and one religion, and Genghis Khan and Alexander, and so forth. But when you take the bigger picture, you see that actually there are processes that are leading in particular direction, no matter what happens. And maybe the most important process of this kind is the process of unification. 10,000 years ago, planet Earth was not a single historical unit. It was divided into thousands of separate human societies with very little connection between them. Over time, the number of separate human societies became smaller and smaller, and today we live in a single unified world. There are still some differences of opinion between people, but the entire world is a single unit. The entire world is a single political, economic, and cultural unit. And even in terms of the worldview, despite all the talk about the clash of civilizations and so forth, actually, almost all societies on Earth share the same basic views about economics, about politics, about nature. 1,000 years ago, if you suffered from a disease and you went to different places around the world, you would get completely different theories about what a disease is, what is the medicine, how to treat the disease, and so forth. Today in the world, it doesn't matter if you suffer from, I don't know, a heart attack or cancer or pneumonia in Colombia or Israel or Japan or Canada.
Get the same treatment.
You'll get the same treatment, the same medicines produced by the same corporations according to the same scientific theories. And the same with physics, with chemistry. If you think about, I don't know, all this business with the Iranian nuclear program. The whole problem is that Americans and Israelis and Iranians all believe in the same physics. If they believed in different physics, then the Americans should not care about the Iranian nuclear program. But because they all believe that E equals MC squared and so forth, then they are very concerned. So they have some minor differences of opinion about religion or politics, but about the basic stuff, about the basic structure of reality, all human societies today on Earth share the same views. And also say even in economics, all people in the world believe in the same money. Money in this sense is more successful than God or human rights or any other ideology. Not all people believe in God or human rights.
But we all believe in the dollar
bill. We all believe in the same money. Again, even the Islamic State, they believe in the dollar. When they took control of Mosul and Raqqa and other cities in Iraq and Syria, they destroyed statues, they tore down flags, but they didn't burn dollars. When they got into a bank and find these paper bills with the pictures of American presidents and with "In God We Trust" in English, they didn't burn them. They took them and made use of them. because even they believe in the dollar bill.
What does it mean that we've become a kind of one world, like one country? Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Like most important development in history, it has both a good side and a bad side. The good side is that this is one of the reasons the world today is far more harmonious. There is far less violence than ever before. The bad side is that we have a very limited pool of ideas, and if the dominant ideas are problematic, they don't work, we don't have an alternative. I mean, today in the world, if you look at the economy, there is just a single economic system, which is capitalism, which everybody believes. Even the Chinese may call themselves communists, but they are, of course, not. And it's very easy and common today to criticize capitalism, and there is a lot of to criticize. There is also a lot to say in its favor, but there is a lot of criticize. The problem is, there is no alternative. The whole world is a single system, and it's becoming more and more difficult to experiment or to explore alternatives to the dominant system. So it's like when you plant the whole field with a single crop. Yep. If it succeeds, it's good. But if there is some problem, like some disease that is spreading, that it's total catastrophe.
So just before we bring in the audience, I would love to ask you, just before we just talk a bit about artificial intelligence and what it's going to mean, one of the things in the book that I thought you didn't answer completely mm-hmm. was, why were men men and women women, and why did women end up subservient to men? Sorry about that. But
it's a very important question. And as I said before, science is the discovery of ignorance. And the amazing thing about gender relations in history is that we are ignorant of the question. We don't have today a good theory why men dominate and have dominated most human societies in history. Now, most people think that it's obvious because men are physically stronger. But it doesn't work, this theory, because not only among human beings, also among other social mammals and animals, social power does not correlate with physical power. Usually, social power correlates with social skills. If you look at human society, then the big boss is usually not the strongest person, he's the person with the best manipulative and social skills. Like if you think about the Catholic Church, then Pope Francis is not the strongest Catholic alive. It's not that they did a big, when they needed to elect a new pope, they had a big tournament, all the priests came, and they had boxing matches, and Francis remained the last one standing, so he became pope. No, it didn't happen like that. And even in criminal organizations, the big boss of the mafia or the criminal organization is not necessarily the strongest person. Very often he might be in his 50s or 60s. His real ability is to make people in their 20s do the dirty work for him. And it's the same with chimpanzees. Among chimpanzees, the alpha male is not the strongest male.
Right.
Is the one
He's
that
just
can
the cleverest.
Establish Whatever. A coalition of supporters. And when it comes to social skills, it's often argued that women have better social skills than men, that they are better in making connections, they are better in understanding how the other person thinks, so all this should have made them the dominant gender. But we know it's not the case. So what happens? We don't have a good theory.
Oh dear, okay, all right. That's... Sorry about that. Okay, so I know that your next book is going to be on the impact of the science that we're going into and on the potential creation of artificial intelligence. And if you say that, or one says that the Industrial Revolution outsourced our muscles, mm-hmm. what's happening with artificial intelligence potentially outsources our brains. So are we looking at a future where no one's got any jobs? No one knows what to do. What do we do? It's happening very fast. I realize when I buy a book on my Kindle and I tap one button, and I was thinking about it the other night, and I was thinking I've eliminated about 15 jobs just in that moment, and it's happening without, you say we're not very good, you know, without us thinking.
Yes, I mean, It's not a prophecy. Nobody knows how the world would look like in 30 years. But it's a very distinct possibility that many experts agree that within 20 to 30 years, maybe 50% of the jobs will be taken over by artificial intelligence and computers. Of course,
that's
new jobs.
That's staggering that people aren't talking about it more.
Yes, I mean, because this is a different issue of what's happening to governments. Governments are basically being transformed from leaders into managers, whereas previously in history, governments looked to the future and had a vision of where we want to be in 10 or 20 years. This is leaders. Now governments in most countries are reduced to being managers. They ran the day-to-day business of the education and the sewage system and all that, but they have absolutely no idea where the country will be in 20 years. Now, many people say, okay, 50% of the jobs will be taken over by AI, but there'll be new jobs. And of course, there will be new jobs. That's certainly true. What we don't know is whether humans will be able to do the new jobs better than AI. Yeah. So you might have a lot of new jobs, which AI still performs better than humans, and you'll see more and more humans being pushed out of the job market and therefore also losing their economic and their political power. We might see humankind after the 20th century, which was characterized by narrowing the gaps between social classes. The 21st century may reopen these gaps and create much bigger social gaps than ever before in history. And you will have also this immense problem of how to keep billions of useless people occupied. I mean, the 19th century, in the Industrial Revolution, created a new massive class of the urban proletariat, which was unprecedented. And much of social and political history of the last century or two revolved around the question what to do with the new class of the urban proletariat. It could be that the 21st century will see the creation of a new massive class of useless people, and the main economic and political question of this century will be what to do with billions of useless people. The best answers we have today are drugs and computer games. If you have people who have nothing to do, just keep them satisfied with medicines and drugs and computer games. Whether it will work on a large scale, we don't know. What we really need at present, above everything else, is new ideas, new ideologies, new concepts that will be adapted to the world of the 21st century, because we are trying to run a 21st century economy and political system with ideas from the 19th and 18th century.
So you say that the governments will be managers and not leaders. Who will be the leaders? Or will we not really have any leaders because it will be whatever Microsoft or Apple or whoever it is in Silicon Valley invents for us?
This is not the future, it's what's happening now. As of 2016, most governments are no longer leaders, they are just managers. Whether anybody will step up and take this role of directing, of leading, I mean, there are certainly people in Silicon Valley who want the job. And if you want to hear really impressive visions about the future of humankind, the place to go is not Washington, and it's certainly not the Middle East, it's Silicon Valley. This is where the new, not only ideologies, the new religions of the 21st century are being created, in Silicon Valley. Whether these visions are good or bad, it's a different question, but it's certainly worrying that a very small group of people who nobody elected and who are very good in technical issues and engineering, but have no real background in philosophy or ethics or the humanities, they are the one, if anybody is shaping the future of humankind, it is them. The other option is even worse, that nobody is in charge. And actually, there is today a kind of ideological backing to having nobody in charge. This is neoliberalism. One of the reasons neoliberalism is so popular today is because it tells governments that you don't need to have a vision, you don't need to understand what is happening, you just need to do your own small
thing. You're micromanaging.
Micromanaging, and market forces will take care of everything else. This is very tempting to believe because it relieves the governments of a lot of responsibility at a time when it is incredibly difficult to really understand what is happening and to try to do something about it.
So the people in Silicon Valley are going to be like Moses appearing with the Ten Commandments. We're going to be right back there with a big myth to get us through and to keep us under control.
A new myth.
Well, a new something.
Yeah, and a new tablet.
A new tablet.
Not the tablets of Moses.
Yeah, a new tablet. Okay.
And we already are walking with the tablets everywhere.
Yeah, well, so they can send us the messages through the tablet. Can we have the lights up? Please come in. Sorry, we've overrun. We've got another 10 minutes, so please come in and ask questions. There's some microphones around, and we've got... That was fantastic. Okay. There's hands... Where are the microphones?
There's at the back. Hello?
Oh, hi. Hello. Hi. I can't see where you are.
At the back.
Okay. Yes. Right. Far ahead.
Hi.
Yeah, my...
Yeah, I have a question.
Oh, wait. Hang on 1 second, sir. Can I have the lady, because she
started?
Thank
you very much. Thank you for such an eloquent talk, but also I have two questions. One regarding our relationship with technology. So how do you see that in your perspective, obviously everything, it's how we use it, and I guess it's not about demonizing these new channels, but how do we keep the balance going into the future, because perhaps I think I can do it, but then I see the new generation that were born with these devices, and it's a completely different story than myself, that I just got it as an adult. So that's one question.
Can you limit yourself to one, because there's lots of hands.
A quick one. No. You said we can foresee up to 4 steps generally, but not to 10. How far could you foresee yourself, between 4 and 10, and what that is? And thank you very much.
Well, I don't think I can foresee more than humankind. I mean, our ability to foresee is just becoming more and more limited. Previously, people could envision how the world would look like in 50 years. Today, we haven't got a clue how the world would look like in 20 years. So our ability to foresee is just shrinking. Regarding technology, yes, it's not good or bad. It's what we do with it. I think the key principle is to use technology for our purposes and not to let technology use us for its purposes. The problem is that most people haven't got any idea what their purposes are. So this is the real issue. When people know what are their real aims and purposes in life, it's quite easy to get a handle of technology. But when you don't know, it's very easy for technology to hijack you and to take you to all kinds of destinations which you never even thought about.
Okay, the microphone there, thank you.
Yes, I would like to ask you about a question that goes back to 70,000 years ago. You mentioned that 100,000 years ago, we were pretty much similar to Neanderthals and other species, human species. But something happened 70,000 years ago that was different and makes us different. That even though they were bigger, and the body was bigger, and the brains also were bigger, we were able to perform better than them, and just something really different happened. And some scholars say that what happened was that we were able to invent language. What is your reaction to that? I would like to hear that.
Well, yes, there is a general agreement that the difference was made by language. It's not that we invented language. It's that, as far as we know, humans evolved new linguistic abilities. Humans and other animals had a system of communication even before. All animals have some system of communication. But the new human language, which evolved around 70,000 years ago, was a completely different kind of a system of communication. The key difference is that all other animals use their communication system only to describe reality. Like you say, lion is coming and everybody runs away. Human language is unique because we can use it to create new realities and not only to describe reality. We can say, look, a lion is coming, everybody runs away, but we can also create realities. We can say, look, there is a God above the clouds, and if you don't do what I tell you to do, he will punish you and send you to hell. Now, this is the creation of a completely new reality, which is not made of atoms or molecules, it is made of words. And this is this ability that enabled Homo sapiens, alone of all the animals, to create these massive networks of cooperation, which gave us control of the world.
Okay.
It's
okay. We'll come to you. Come to you next. But the gentleman there's got the mic.
Yeah, it's quite clear in your book on what's the role of Latin America was in history. What's the role today? What Latin America has to say today in history?
Well, at present, again, as I said, it's extremely difficult to foresee what the world would be like in 20 years. Not only in Latin America, everywhere. What we can say is that the world is in the middle of a kind of new industrial revolution. In the 19th century, the biggest thing that happened was the Industrial Revolution, and for every country on Earth in the 19th century, the really important question was whether it was part of the Industrial Revolution or not. Very few countries were part of the Industrial Revolution. Britain, France, Germany, Japan, they became the dominant powers of the world for the next century or two centuries. Most countries, including most Latin American countries, were left far behind. They had more important stuff to worry about when the Industrial Revolution began in Britain, and they were left behind. And it took countries like China, like Brazil, 150 years to close the gap, or start close the gap, that opened in the 19th century. Now we see the beginning of a second, of a new Industrial Revolution. This time, it's a revolution based not on steam engines and oil and electricity, it's based on biotechnology and computers. This time, the main products of the revolution will not be textiles and trains and steamships, they will be bodies and brains and minds. These are the main products of the 21st century, bodies, brains and minds. And the biggest question any country on Earth faces today is whether it will be a part of this revolution or not. If you're left behind this time, you will probably never get a second chance. Countries that missed the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century got a second chance in the 20th. But if you miss the second Industrial Revolution, it's over. Wow. The gap between a society that knows how to engineer and manufacture bodies and brains, and the society that doesn't know how to do it, is far, far bigger than the gap between a society that can engineer a steam engine and a society that can't. So once this gap is opened, it will probably never be closed, and therefore the big question facing Latin American countries and all countries in the world is whether they are part of this revolution or not.
Okay. Yes,
very short. Thank you so much for a great conference and for a great book that I read last year. You spoke about very important trends and this automation, technology, industry 4.0, you name it. But I'd like that you take a few minutes discussing a challenge that I think is even bigger than the hordes of useless people. is demography. How do you see this coming as a person that looks at evolution and the pace of change? How do you see the next... I know that you can't forecast, but, you know, demography, I think, is a much bigger issue than technology.
Well, at present, birth rates in more and more countries are dropping. I think it's a very positive development that countries like Japan, like Germany, are actually shrinking. And you see it in other countries, even in Morocco. The average number of babies per couple in Morocco is just 2.1. So it's not just a phenomenon of Western Europe or of North America or Japan. And I think it's a very positive development. The world would be a much better place with a few billion people less, if it's being done simply by having few babies and not by some extermination or whatever.
Okay. Have we got time for one more? Okay. Where is the... Can I have this gentleman down here? And then... Okay. We'll come to you and then I'm afraid we'll have to stop.
What could be the reasons why humans have evolved the way they have, you know, like having super technology, space traveling, and like all those kind of amazing things, like we have evolved immensely, and all the other species have not. Mm-hmm. I mean, a cat does the same today as it used to do, like, all the years ago,
yeah.
But we don't. What could be the reasons for that?
The basic ability, again, is cooperation. If you think about space travel, this is not something that some very bright individual invented all by herself or himself. A space program is the outcome of cooperation between millions of people over many, many generations. And almost all technological and scientific and economic advances throughout history were the result of large-scale networks of cooperation. Of course, sometimes you have a particular individual, like Einstein or like Columbus, who gives an extra push. But if Einstein had appeared thousands of years ago without the infrastructure being prepared by millions of other people, he would not have discovered the theory of relativity. So, as I said in the beginning, so now the key is really cooperation. What drives humans to try and make more and more inventions and discoveries all the time, it's maybe the basic reason is their dissatisfaction. What characterizes Homo sapiens, our species, is that on the one hand, we are very, very good in acquiring more power. On the other hand, we are very bad in translating power into happiness. So as you look at history for thousands of years, you see that humans are becoming more and more powerful, but they don't become more satisfied. The basic reaction of the human mind to achievement, any achievement, in personal life or in the collective life of a nation, the basic reaction to achievement is almost always not satisfaction, but rather craving for more. And this is why we have become so powerful without becoming much happier than our ancestors.
Okay, on that incredibly cheery note. Thank you very, very, very much. It's fantastic to have you here, and I hope you will come back with your next book.